Hello and welcome to the Immigrantly Hive. I am Sadia Khan. What you just listened to was my life right before the interview. And moving forward, I'll be sharing snippets from what I'm doing before each interview at the top of each episode so you can get a sense of where my head and heart are as I sit down with each guest. Before we begin, I want to ask you for a quick favor, but even before that, happy Election Day, New Yorkers. Don't forget to cast your vote. And remember, don't be driven by fear, but by hope for what can be. And now to the favor. If you listen to your podcasts on Apple, please consider subscribing to our channel, Immigrantly Uninterrupted, for as low as $3.99 a month. That means you'll get ad-free content. But honestly, that's not the real reason I am asking. I want you to subscribe because I know you believe in what we are building here. Bold, unapologetic conversations that take time, care, and a whole lot of heart to make. We are a small, independent network that gives us freedom, but it also means ads and sponsorships can be unpredictable. So if you believe in this work, if you value nuance, vulnerability, and stories that don't fit neatly into categories, your support will help us keep going. Now, I also want to start today's episode with honesty. Yes, I'm leading with unadulterated honesty today. Sometimes I do get anxious about how people perceive me, my work, these conversations. Do they find them meaningful, boring, maybe even a little nonsensical? And yet I keep showing up. I keep creating. So here I am once again with another guest who reminds me why I do this. Today's guest is Shobha Rao, a writer whose words are as fearless as they are tender. Her acclaimed novel, Girls Burn Brighter, followed two young women whose friendship becomes both refuge and rebellion in a world that tries to crush them. It's a story about endurance, about how light persists even in ruin. And I'm so in awe of all the work that she's created. And now with her latest book, Indian Country, Shobha turns her lens to America, exploring belonging, displacement, and the uneasy intersections of identity, history, and power. So without further ado, let's get started. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for having me on. It's such a pleasure.
So, Shobha, you're based in San Francisco, right?
Well, currently I'm not in San Francisco, but notoriously San Francisco is a really cold place. People think it's so warm, but no. San Francisco has this marine layer, and it's this foggy, moist, cold layer that comes in late afternoon, early evening. And it's so notorious that we have a name for it. In San Francisco, we named it Carl, the fog. We're like, well, here comes Carl. So
I've been to San Francisco twice. I loved it. I still do. I haven't been back in almost 15 years. Oh my gosh. Oh. It's so weird. It's so weird.
You're overdue for a visit.
I am. I am scared of flying. So San Francisco from New York seems so far. It will take me a year to prep myself to travel to San Francisco. Yeah, it's not easy for me.
It's not easy. It's a long flight and the slightest bit of turbulence. And I start thinking of mortality and look, we're just suspended in the sky. And I know there's physics and aerodynamics, but none of that applies when there's turbulence. You're like, I'm going to die.
Yes. Yes. Thank you for saying that. Thank you for validating my emotions, because everybody's like, why are you so scared? And I'm like, guys, as you said, we are really suspended in the air. There's no ground underneath, right? I couldn't run out. So I have your book, Indian Country, with me. Let me show you that. And I'm so excited because I'm reading it.
Wonderful. Look at that.
I just love what I've read so far. But before we delve into your book, let's go back in time. Let's rewind. You were born in India. You came to the US when you were 7. Interesting age, right?
Right. So you're conscious. You can form memories. You can tell your parents what you want. You know, you have language. But what was interesting about moving at that age is that, you know, nothing is quite firm in your world yet. Still a little wobbly. Moving to the United States, especially without knowing very much English. In fact, I probably only knew a few handful of words. So when I moved to the United States, it felt like I've lost my country of my birth. As a 7-year-old, that's what it seems like. But I also lost language in many, many ways. So just the ability to speak to my peers or tell a story or engage in like sort of schoolyard banter, I lost that. And I think what happens is every other sense sort of sharpens. And so your sort of sense of sight, so what you observe and your more formation of memory and, you know, your noticing of the quality of light or even the color of the lollipop, you know, this other kid is eating and you want it, but you can't articulate. I feel like that was the genesis of my becoming a writer. So I think my powers of sort of, you know, narrating the world to myself were in some ways refined.
So when you say you were aware of losing your homeland or the country that you were born into, as a 7-year-old, did you have that conscious awareness?
So I don't think it was a conscious awareness. I think it's most certainly a subconscious one. And as a child, you know, it's like any new event, like going to a zoo or going to the amusement park or, you know, whatever, it's exciting and it's mysterious and it's a grand adventure. But I did feel in some sort of fundamental primal place, a sense of loss. You can't articulate it. Maybe to this day, I can't articulate it. But it was a sense I had, because when we said goodbye to my grandmothers, for instance, it felt like a bigger goodbye than the usual.
The sense of loss was manifesting probably for you through lost relationships, right?
Absolutely. Friendships, familial relationships, cousins, and even landscape, right? So we moved to Virginia our first year, and I had grown up in Kanpur, born and raised in Kanpur up till then. And Kanpur, for those who don't know, is a huge urban city in northern India. And to come to Virginia, which was kind of, you know, we landed in kind of a rural, not rural, but a smaller town. You're like, oh, yes, this is a change of landscape, but it's also a loss of landscape. It creates a kind of a two-person bifurcated individual inside yourself, even as a child.
Describe to me the soundscape of Virginia versus Kanpur.
So Kanpur was full of street vendors, you know, yelling out their wares. And I had a big group of children that I played with, and the heat and the summer time, they seemed to like just last forever. In Virginia, we arrived in the United States in January. And so...
Oh, no.
So what happened is my first memory of soundscape is actually my first experience of snowfall. And being from New York, you know, the quiet, the kind of stillness that overtakes a place during a snowfall, even in New York, certainly in Virginia. And so that kind of quiet, I had never known it. And you're watching these big snowflakes fall, and it's all very confusing and exciting, but it is incredibly still. And that is my first memory.
Shobha, was there a moment or a series of events after which you started to feel more at home? Was language the first barrier that you overcame?
Absolutely. My first experience, I want to say, my first memory of entering the English language is a bookmobile came around to our school. And I didn't know what a bookmobile was, but every student who I guess had done, you know, well on some math test got to pick out a free book. And that also was like so unknown and alien to me. And so the first book I picked out, Sadia, was Little House on the Prairie by Laura Ingalls Wilder. And I do think that what pulled me into Little House on the Prairie, among all the other books there, was the cover. And if you're not familiar with it, it's the back of this wagon with Laura and Mary looking out as they're traveling to the prairie. And perhaps reminiscent of my sister and I. Now I look at the cover, I'm like, of course, I saw myself, you know, in these two little girls traveling into this unknown. And I then got into all the Laura Ingalls Wilder books and read them all in the coming years. But that book established my first entrance to the United States, my first understanding of the United States.
So let's expand that conversation. Through that book, how did you come to see America?
Oh, wow. So many things come to mind. First of all, the endless pursuit of new lives, new adventures, new homes. This concept of America as this sort of vast place of opportunity, the golden light of the prairie, you know, it beckoned me in a way that it still does.
So Shobha, looking back now, what are parts of the book that disappoint you?
Again, so many things. So first of all, the Ingalls family was not allowed to be where they were, where they sort of set up their homestead. It was Native American land by treaty. Then you get into that violence of American settlement, white settler, and the illegal seizing of lands. It's a children's book. So let's, you know, acknowledge that. So she's not going to talk, and she didn't talk about the true hardship and the true costs of their riding into this land and declaring it theirs. And it costs so much.
You bring up an important point, and I do want to expand this conversation a bit and dig deeper. When you say it's a children's book, so she did not discuss the human cost or the politics of the situation, right? Don't you think what we see in the world right now, maybe we need to reorient ourselves and start young with our children so that they understand the human cost and the suffering of occupation or settlements or any kind of oppressive, repressive ideology?
I absolutely agree. In fact, I think it's imperative that children are taught that, look, and by the way, children are absolutely able to grasp complexity and a mix of histories and how the tensions that are carried within these histories. Now, we don't have to tell them certain things, certain violence, and or elucidate certain histories. But I do think they're absolutely able to contain those multitudes of history. And there are ways to write a book for children that, you know, can encompass these very difficult places, difficult histories, difficult stories in a way that celebrates them and honors them. And I think that we grew up with a deep appreciation if we're told these things without sugarcoating them, without sort of, you know, whitewashing them. And I remember a friend of mine told me he'd grown up in rural Wisconsin, and he told me that he hadn't heard about the Civil War, the American Civil War, until he got to college. And, you know, what an incredible loss to not understand and not be taught these things. So yes, I think there is a way to write children's books that honors these complexities and these histories while still honoring the life of a child.
Absolutely. And fast forward to now, Shobha, you are an established writer. Was being a reader your first foray into becoming a writer?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, as we moved around to different parts of the country to settle, I would find myself quite isolated in some of these spaces. In that isolation, I found books. I found reading as a way to understand my world, to understand my my isolation. And books for me became companions. And not just companions, I mean, friends. You know, that truly it was a place where I could find people to talk to. And to, you know, it's strange to say, but certainly books became deep, wondrous places to meet my peers and to have conversations with characters. And so I think of Frankenstein and how Frankenstein's monster, you know, in his isolation, I'm not saying it was equal to mine, or, but it, I could see myself in him in a way that was a place of rest and communion for me. Strange to say, but it was so true. And so as I grew up and entered my 20s, I thought, well, maybe I can write. Instead of just reading, maybe I can write a thing that I can, that'll be a companion to another lonely kid somewhere in the world.
So what was the first thing that you wrote for somebody else?
Well, I think the first thing I wrote must have been for myself, just to see if I could and to see if I could see myself in that work. But the first thing I tried and failed miserably in writing was a short story. I thought, oh, a short story, that looks easy. You know, it's only like 10 or 12 pages. I can do this. Oh my gosh, was I wrong? I mean, truly, desperately wrong. Short stories are incredibly challenging. They have to be concise. They have to be piercing in their language, imagistic. I mean, very incredibly challenging. You know, I was naive, but maybe we all enter all difficult things with the kind of naivete.
So what kept you going?
Phew, what a question. Something inside me that believed in the power of the written word, in its power to befriend, in its power to comfort, in its power to sort of reach another human being, to extend that beautiful companionship, that hand of friendship. I always thought, you know, it took me 15 years to publish anything. From the day I sat down to the day I published, you know, a short piece, 15 years of learning the craft. And all those years, I have to say it was wanting to reach another human being.
Shobha, what is your relationship with failure? How do you see failure in life?
Certainly necessary, because it teaches us to persevere. It teaches us that failure is not an end, that is truly a beginning. And it shows us that there are no boundaries. There are no borders to what we can do. So, Sadia, let's be clear. I'm not even talking about publication. right? I'm talking about, because that's an external measure of success. The internal measure was accomplished when I was able to write, to translate the thing inside my head onto the page. And I knew it. I knew the day I did that, that what I had imagined in my head was now on the page. And that is the success I'm talking about. And that took 15 years.
In June 2024, a teenager attended a music festival and never returned.
Miles and miles away from where he was staying, up a mountain.
Wasn't gone 3 days and turned into Pablo Escobar.
The online sleuths had lost sight of this was somebody's son.
The disappearance of Jay Slater on Channel 4. Stream now.
I assume you are at least bilingual, if not multilingual, right? Does English ever resist the emotional truths you are trying to tell?
You know, I think we have to, as a writer who writes in English, of course I know how gorgeous English is, how incredibly rich it is, and how much is possible. I also know there are limitations. So for instance, I'm fluent in Telugu, which is a South Indian language that we speak in Andhra Pradesh, which is where I'm from. And one word that comes to mind immediately is this word kala, right, in Telugu.
Kala, art form, yeah.
Well, yeah, indeed, but here's what specifically within this art form I'm thinking of. Kala is this brightness in a face. Now, I say brightness, but it's not quite translatable. It's this kind of coming together of features in a face that makes it kind of glow, and is, there's a brilliance, and there's a, again, there's no
English equivalent of it.
Exactly. And so, you know, a beautiful face on a magazine cover could be beautiful, but doesn't necessarily have kala, because it's an artistic light glow from within. It doesn't even have to be a beautiful face. It can still have kala. So those are the kind of untranslatable things that I notice on occasion. But then English has those as well. It can't be translated into Telugu. So that's the richness of language, right? When we say, oh, wow, there's this thing, that, you know, that this element that English has that Telugu doesn't, or that German does, that Spanish doesn't, et cetera, et cetera. And those are wonderful spaces, those liminal spaces where you're like, oh, how fun. I just found a word that can't be translated, you know, and I relish those.
What is the language that you normally think in?
English, I would say, after all these years having lived and spoken English. But every now and then, you know, I will think a thought in Telugu, certainly like these public spaces, you know, where I have a thought. It's so fun. And, you know, then it's even more fun when I get to speak Telugu in a public space to a family member or something, and to make an observation or to, you know, whatever, be silly. And that's so much fun.
So let's pivot and talk about Indian country, right? Now, the title, and I'm sure a lot of people have asked you about the title. I was listening to a couple of podcasts you've been on. It makes sense to start there because the title does carry both colonial and indigenous echoes, right? But what tensions were you trying to resolve through the title?
I would say it was less tensions and more, I was more aspiring to connect what on their surface feel like disparate histories. So the legacy of British colonialism in India and, you know, Manifest Destiny and Western expansion in the Americas. So they seem like they're a world apart, right? But what I was trying to do with Indian country is to say, look, what on its surface seems so far apart, and what it on its surface seems like, oh, some mistake that Christopher Columbus made 500 years ago that we're still living with. That is true. But if we go to a deeper place, we see how our traumas connect, how our losses can be shared, how we can find a place of common humanity. And I'm not saying the histories are the same. I'm not saying the traumas are equivalent. Of course not. These things are not to be compared. And it is an insult to these histories to try to compare them. But on a far more fundamental human level, I say, why don't we share our stories? Why don't we look at the word Indian and say, oh, how interesting. What does it mean to you? And what does it mean to me? And let's talk. And so it's that aspiration that I chose that title with.
So in this book, you are really pivoting to focus more on America, the sense of belonging, identity. When you were writing this, or when you write about America, what mindset are you in? Do you feel like you've claimed it? You are an American who's writing about America, or are you still translating and figuring it out?
Oh, wow. What a profound question. Honestly, I don't write as an American writing about America. In fact, to me, now I feel sort of stateless. And in fact, if I had to choose a country, it would be literature. That is where I feel most at home, as I'm writing, as torturous as it can be. Isn't every home, right? In some ways, torturous. But also as a place of solace and as a place of community and meaning and comfort. To me, that is right as a writer and as a reader in literature is where I find home. And I think I'm more defined by my yearning for home than my finding of it. Once you emigrate, I think you're always caught between worlds.
Even as a 7-year-old?
Absolutely. Not only do I have those first formative years in India, right? The first memories, the first rising to consciousness, the first understanding of the world I live in, but also we traveled back to India, to my grandparents, my ancestral village, quite often growing up. And so I would spend these long, hot summers in India almost every year in a village that didn't have reliable electricity, that didn't, you know, for the first years of my returning, didn't have running water. We'd have a water pump or we'd have to go to the well to get water. And, you know, these long, listless, beautiful summers of heat and, you know, hanging out with relatives and eating all these Indian snacks and trying to cool off. I mean, these were also my understanding of home and how life is lived. And that has also formed who I am deeply. And so, yes, still, I think of myself as a person caught between two wonderful worlds, if not even more, if I add all the novels I've read and all the, you know, places those have homes that they've built inside me. For which I'm so grateful. I feel like it's made me a more imaginative person than I would have been otherwise, a more curious person, and a less inhibited person. So, you know, when I think of home, it is so many things. And I really cherish all of those things.
So let's talk about the book itself, the story. We don't want to give away too much. We'll just touch on a few things and we want readers to read the book. I was curious to know, how did you come up with the protagonist names? Now, people talk a lot about titles, right? But then what was the thought process behind naming Janhvi and Sagar?
So Janhvi came early on in my writing because I knew that the novel, one of the great symbols in the novel, one of the great actual places in the novel was going to be Varanasi, which is the holiest city in Hinduism. And then, of course, the Ganga, the Ganges River, which flows through Varanasi. So I knew the Ganges, the Ganga River would have prominent, would be one of the most prominent characters, truly, in this novel. And the Ganga has 108 names, which is a sacred number in Hinduism. And one of these names is Jahnavi, right? So the Jahnavi. And so I picked Jahnavi because it was one of the names of the Ganga. And as I'm on Google Maps, right, doing my research, I see that, you know, and I'm following the Ganges as it flows through India. And I get to where it empties into the Bay of Bengal. And I see that there's a little island that is really the last island in the mouth of the Ganges before it empties into this vast Bay of Bengal. And this last island is called Sagar Island. Indian country, my novel is about many, many things, but it's also the story of a marriage, the early years of a marriage. And I thought, what is, you know, in thinking about marriage, I thought, what is it? Like, what truly is marriage? And something about being the last island that this, the Jahnavi empties toward, and that it is the last piece of land, the last piece of certainty, the last solid thing as the Jahnavi journeys through hundreds of miles before it enters the unknown. The Sagar Island is where it can rest. Something about it symbolically and actually in the life of a marriage.
So after writing this story, what have you discovered about marriage that people may not know?
That like a river, I suppose, that is constantly reinventing itself. And, you know, rivers are not static things, right? They're constantly shifting, whether forced through sediment or flooding or rains or the lack of rains or drought, etc. And I so feel that marriage is the same thing. You have to be able to shift. You have to be able to learn things anew, make adjustments thereof, to sort of be open to taking on new understandings, new ideas, and to reshape ourselves based on those new things, the new ideas and those new challenges and the new ways which you understand your partner. You never stop learning about who this person is that you committed yourself to, because they're constantly growing and you're constantly growing, and often it's not in the same direction. So what do? You have to meet that person, right, in an honor where they're going and where you're going. And so you shift who you are and to accommodate these new ideas and these new understandings. And that is the creativity of marriage. That's the adventure of marriage. Boy, is it difficult.
Tell me about it.
But that's what we're tasked to do, right, in a marriage. And some days you just throw your hands up in there and say, you know what, I'm exhausted. This long-term relationship thing is beautiful, but it's also incredibly challenging, frustrating. And we have to learn how to accommodate and mutate. And that's, you know, as human beings, what is evolution? That is the ability to mutate.
Oh my God, Shobha, I love the word mutate. That is so apt and it's so spot on. If a word could describe marriage exactly in its messiness and ebbs and flows, mutate is what comes to mind. So yeah, thank you for sharing that word. I'll be talking to my therapist about this today.
And you just used the phrasing ebbs and flows, which is exactly what rivers do, you know? And so I think we have to embrace that continuity of a river and its ability to take on whatever is thrown at it, which is so much of what we do as people in relationships.
Ready to launch your business? Get started with the commerce platform made for entrepreneurs. Shopify is specially designed to help you start, run, and grow your business with easy, customizable themes that let you build your brand, marketing tools that get your products out there, integrated shipping solutions that actually save you time. From startups to scale-ups, online, in person, and on the go, Shopify is made for entrepreneurs like you.
Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/setup.
So in this story, their marriage is against the backdrop of arranged marriage and some reluctancy, right, in marrying one another. Were you at any point concerned about reinforcing stereotypes around arranged marriage through this story?
Yes, I was deeply concerned, especially because, you know, there's a betrothal element to it, which is such a sort of antiquated, I'm not saying it doesn't happen anymore, but it's, even in India, it's quite antiquated, right? So I did struggle with that. But my response to that in many ways was to say, sure, Sagar and Jahnavi are entering this arranged marriage and there is a betrothal element. And yes, it's not at all common anymore. But my response to that was to make them incredibly modern, self-empowered and within the relationship.
But why do you think having an arranged marriage and being modern or contemporary are somehow mutually exclusive?
Are they? I don't know. And so my, I don't know.
I don't think they are, though.
Because it's still a choice.
I mean, the Western interpretation of arranged marriage is pretty warped and messed up. In Pakistan, where I grew up, although I did not have an arranged marriage, a lot of people do, and it is still a choice to marry somebody. And yes, there are instances where girls are not allowed to choose, and those are unfortunate, you know, situations. And I'm not saying that every single arranged marriage means that a girl or a boy has a choice, but in most instances, they do. It's almost as if your parents become the matchmakers. And there are a lot of added layers, right? I am not in any way discounting the impact that caste system, especially in India, has on arranged marriages, which is added layer of discrimination. And I'm sure there is some socioeconomic element to arranged marriages, even in Pakistan. And I'm not downplaying any of it. But I just feel like arranged marriage is more than how the West sees it or understands it.
Oh, gosh. And, you know, I think from the West, it's seen as a sort of monolithic thing where...
Like every other thing from the East.
Absolutely. And but it's so much more complex, as you say, and so much, you know, there is a lot more choice embedded now. But in terms of characterization, I was, you know, getting back to the book, Jahnavi was in my writing... You know, she was like, I don't even know if I want to get married. She was launching into this wonderful career as an advocate for street children that she was so enjoying and feeling the importance of her work and so forth. And so that is what I was up against in terms of having her marry through this arranged, duplicitous, in fact, because her sister does this thing, makes this decision that sort of puts Jahnavi in this firing line. And she has to make this sort of deeply compromised decision. I won't say what it is. And so ends up married to Sagar. And so it wasn't just arranged marriage that I'm speaking to. It was about this greater... almost false choice that Jahnavi is presented with. Jahnavi is placed in this uniquely difficult situation.
So for Indian country, Shobha, what do you want readers to take away from it?
I think what I really, really want people to take away from it is that is how connected we are to each other. That what on the surface may seem separates us, if we just go a layer or two deeper, we'll see how in some ways those same things connect us. Yes, let's honor the ways in which our stories are different, but let's also have the humanity to sort of say, well, yes, the details of our lives are different, but we are all on this human journey. It's a hard thing. I'm not going to say it's easy, but if anything, I want this novel to maybe, you know, peel off some of those layers and see beyond the surface of what we're being told are our differences, and to really, you know, challenge our journeys to connect with another that seems different. And it is different, but there are commonalities always, because we are ultimately in this together.
Mm-hmm. And Shobha, in the end, if you were to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
I would say the celebration of diversity, I think. The ways in which we, so many of us, are immigrants and come from immigrants. And so the celebration of diversity is how I've always seen the United States. And I won't let them take that away from us.
Thank you so much, Shobha. This was such a wonderful interview. Where do you want people to get the book from? Is there a small bookstore that you want them to go to?
Well, if you have an independent bookstore in your community, please support them. If not, bookshop.org supports independent bookselling. So if those are possible for you, I would love for you to get the book through those avenues. And if buying the book is not possible for you, then your local library. I'm going to Montana soon, which I'm so excited about. So if you're in anywhere in Western Montana, I would love to see you. And of course, I get all types of cities and I visit. So you can find me there and I'd love to see you.
Thank you, Shobha. This was wonderful. And when you are in New York, do ping me.
It would be my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Shobha has such kind, calm voice. As I was speaking with her, I felt like whatever she was saying made so much sense. And guys, I love this book, Indian Country. I will hopefully finish it soon. If you haven't read it, if you don't know about the book, check it out. You know what? I keep thinking we should have a podcast club, like a book club. Listen to podcasts and get together once a month and just talk about all the audio consumption that we do in that month. So let me know if any of you are interested. You can reach me at sadia@immigrantlypod.com. Also, as I said in my intro, don't forget to check out our channel on Apple Podcasts. It's called Immigrantly Uninterrupted. There's something else I'll be sharing with all of you very soon. It's a learning app that I'm working on, which will be available. And I'll tell you where, when, and how. Would love for all of you to check that out and give me some feedback. So yeah, that's work in progress. We'll get back to you once it launches, hopefully end of November. Keeping my fingers crossed, inshallah. And don't forget to come back next week for another conversation. This episode was written and produced by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our incredible sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrantly's theme music is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Yeah, see you guys next week. Be kind to others and don't forget to vote.